What if we not?
I just don't want to wake up with anybody writing on my face. The other issue is that I do have, I have a hard stop because I have to fly out, so getting it to the airport. So 4 o'clock, if we aren't finished, we'll do a transition and I have to hit the door. But with that, we'll call the meeting to order, and I'll ask for a motion to accept the minutes of the March 28th, 2015.
So moved. Seconded.
All right. Any exception to those minutes? Seeing none, approved unanimously. And I will turn the podium over to our president.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you for our second council meeting, I think, since I arrived in January. We have been very, very busy since the last time we met. We continue to interface with as many faculty and staff governance groups and visiting our research centers and having dialogue with student leaders and student groups as a way of familiarizing myself with the university, its constituencies, and the challenges and opportunities we face. In fact, things have been going so well, I feel complete now. I've had a complete experience in 4.5 months. Because I had my first student protest last Monday, I guess it was, one of those days, I'm not sure when it was, but there's a group called the Student Revolutionary Coalition who rallied outside the hall here for a half hour or so. There was about 50 very passionate students who had a list of demands that they wanted me to agree to right on the spot, and they were not to be negotiated, so we had a dialogue about that wasn't a good place to start.
Tactics you talk about.
I worked in the 60s.
Right. Those things didn't work that well in the 60s. I'm afraid they won't work in this century either. But we did have it was a good opportunity, I think, for the students to dig a bit and to vet some of their concerns. And they raised a lot of substantive issues. Some of their issues, I thought, were not well thought out and not well researched, but they did raise some issues that we feel that we have an obligation to look at as we move forward. And so how we followed up with about an hour and a half forum with them last Tuesday, where we had a chance to sit down with them, and we invited the entire student body to come and participate in that forum. So we could not only hear from the Student Revolutionary Coalition, but any interested student that wanted to have a conversation with the president and the administration about the things that they were concerned about. And so where we left it is that, of course, they wanted me to meet with them on a monthly basis. I had to remind them that they're 200 student organizations, so they reminded me that I work for them to take my salary. I thought that was just factual, but interesting perspective. But what we will be doing, and it's something we had planned to do anyway, we will be having quarterly meetings, open forum, where we will invite all students to come and have a chance to discuss issues that they're concerned about. This is something that I initiated on behalf of a new president at Minnesota, and it worked extremely well. But not only we will be having these for students, we will be having them for faculty and staff as well, as an opportunity to come and basically just have a conversation once a semester. And I think it'll be an opportunity, hopefully, well, people will understand that we have an open door as much as possible, and we're willing to listen to any concerns that they might have, because, as I said, the students raised some issues that I think we have an obligation and responsibility to be a bit more strategic and intentional about. And so I appreciate their advocacy and their ability to express their concerns, and it just shows us that we're educating students here that will leave here, and hopefully will continue to be civically engaged and responsible in that regard. We are continuing our 9-county tour. I think I mentioned to you the last time we met, we just finished the Green County tour, but since that time we've had 4 other additional counties that we visited. We visited Schenectady, Albany, Washington, and Columbia County. These tours are helping me to learn more about the Capital Region, both as my responsibility as president of this university, but also in my responsibility as co-chair of the Capital Region Economic Development Council. And so it's been a great opportunity to hear from the individuals that we've had a chance to meet. And each of these tours, we make a point of the first meeting always being with the superintendent and hopefully a principal of one of the K through 12 school districts. And that has led to, I think, some very good conversations and some wonderful opportunities for us to leverage and to create a better engagement, I think, with some of those high schools and K through 12 institutions, a much more engaged strategy than what we have currently. And they've been very good conversations. It's provided us an opportunity to look for other partnership opportunities with the economic development entities in those counties, whether you're talking about the chambers of commerce or whatever the entity might be. That's led to some good conversations, as well as we've been connecting with as many nonprofits as we possibly can as well, those that particularly are designed to serve underserved communities and oppressed communities. So we think this is raising the visibility of the university, but also providing a better opportunity for me to understand these regions and their needs, which I think will help me in my leadership role as one of the co-chairs of the Capital Region Economic Development Council. Everyone on that council knows these communities intimately because they've lived here for 10, 15, 20 years or more. And as a newbie on the corner, it's helpful for me to have a perspective on these communities as we move into the next round of deciding which projects will be supported as part of that process. So next week, we'll be in Saratoga County on the May 29th, and so I think we have five down and four to go. I think because of the math we're using is that now there are nine counties, not eight in the capital region. So it's that new math you'll have to get used to. Our research alliance that I think most of you are familiar with RPI and Albany Medical College hosted its first research symposium a few weeks ago. It was very, very successful. There were over 100 biomedical research partners around the table that included industry leaders and policymakers. And they convened basically to discuss ways that they could foster greater collaboration. As you know, the goal of the alliance is to create these partnerships with research institutions across the region. How can we leverage our collective intellectual and physical R&D capacity to really help drive innovation, economic development, and vitality of the region. And one of the biggest opportunities, I think, from having these three large research entities, powerhouses, come together is the opportunity to translate basic science research into some practical uses and commercial healthcare applications as well. So we think this is a tremendous opportunity that's going to lead for some synergies around the area of translational research. And there are some big ideas and some potential big grant opportunities, I think, maybe forthcoming because of this alliance that that has been formed. We have been continuing our discussion about and emphasizing the importance of the university being an engaged university. So we had Dr. Andy Furco, a colleague of mine from Minnesota that I hired about 5 years ago, to drive the public engagement office in that system. And he came here, and I think it's fair to say had a wonderful two-day experience working with our faculty to get them to think differently about public engagement, to help them think about ways to, how do you really infuse public engagement? It's not something that we do when we have time, but how we think about it as a core part of our teaching and research and service mission, our outreach mission, and how public engagement is something that cuts across those three very, very important areas of the university. So, by all accounts, it was a very interesting and dynamic 2.5 days, and I think we're well on our way to really emphasize the importance of public engagement as a core value of the university. On Wednesday evening, just a couple days ago, we had a chance to recognize a very wide array of university community partners award ceremony where we recognized outstanding university community partnerships. There were approximately 150 people in attendance, and people really appreciate the fact that the university would take time not only to engage with them but to recognize some of the exemplars in terms of the partnerships that are really working and bring about change in the community. And And I'd just like to again thank Marianne Trimantozzi for the outstanding, her staff, for the outstanding work they did in this effort. Albany was named as one of the America's most environmentally responsible colleges, according to Princeton Review recently. And so we're very, very pleased with that. We will be also having a grand opening on June 11th. I'd like you to mark your calendars for that. The new home to our pioneering RDA Institute will have its grand opening on that day. We will be hosting a ribbon-cutting ceremony to celebrate the completion of this $1.5 million addition to our RDA Institute. This is really a unique program, and that's one of the things I love about this university. We have a number of one-of-a-kind, unique opportunities that we have the opportunity to really excel and advance this for not only the state, for the rest of the nation and the world. And I think the RDA Institute is clearly poised to do that. This was, if you may remember, was one of the highest ranked projects on the REDC funding initiative. There are a number of Nobel laureates and other members that serve on the advisory committee for this institute. And so they're members of the National Academy of Science, the European Academy of Science, and there are two Howard Hughes medical investigators that also serve on the on the advisory committee. One of the, there also is going to be a Nobel laureate. He's going to be a featured speaker at this grand opening. RDA scientist Ada Yonath, who's a member of the Institute, will be speaking at the celebration. So it's a big deal, and I certainly hope that those of you that can will come and participate. As I said, this is clearly, I think, one of the growing areas of strength for the university, as one of the areas where we've made some substantive investments, but I think there's more we need to do to really help advance this institute. The RDA Institute has a key research engine of this great university. You all know the women and men's basketball NCAA story, so we won't repeat all of that, but it's been great to have an opportunity to celebrate the victory of our young student athletes. We had a remarkable event downstairs several weeks ago with tremendous turnout to recognize the coaches and the athletic director and these young folks, and that went extremely well. In fact, I think it's important to emphasize that not only are we successful in basketball, but our overall athletic teams have done remarkable work in 2012-2013. Four of our coaches were named to conference coaches of the year. 95 of our student-athletes achieved all conference honors. And I think it's also important that our student-athletes have succeeded not only in the playing field, but in the classroom as well. And I think that's one of the things I can't say enough. This is what distinguishes us and sets us apart, I think, from a lot of other athletic programs where the emphasis is all about winning and less attention paid to whether or not the students are focusing on their academics first. And this has really set us apart, and I'm pleased to report that the average GPA of our student athletes is about 3.0, and our team has produced 20 academic all-conference athletes. And our student athletes have, they also have a sense of civic engagement as well. They have donated or contributed over 2,500 hours to community service in this past year alone. So these are not only folks that are competitive on the courts and on the field of competition, they're competitive in the classroom, but they have a deep sense of civic engagement. They give back to the community, and we should all be very proud of them. For the university, it's also important to note that to those of the council members that are interested in lacrosse, and I know there's one special in this area, and all of us care about this team as well. Our number 13th ranked men lacrosse team will be playing number 4 ranked Denver in the first round on Saturday, this Saturday evening. It's going to be an amazing game. I understand the coach has already been out pontificating about they were going to win. So you got to go into this with the right attitude. You know, you can't go in and say, well, we're going to do the best we can. So we're very, very pleased with the fact that this was the third of our teams to win the American Youth Championship this year, and so we wish them well in their pursuit of a first-round win in the NCAA tournament. We also broke ground yesterday, if I remember, on the renovation to the track and field.
No, Wednesday.
Wednesday? Okay, thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Wednesday.
Fact-checking. Fact-checking,
right. On Wednesday. And so this is another part of the strategy to upgrade our athletic facilities for our students. And so we're very, very pleased with this. And it seems that our new football stadium is on track to open this fall. I happened to be trolling around campus last week and had the pleasure of seeing them start to lay the turf for the new stadium, so we're they're making progress, so we should be set for opening of the stadium in the fall. Just in closing.
Somewhere, I'm not sure where, you're gonna get your marching band.
Yeah.
You talked to me early on and said, what's a program without a marching band? And I don't know where I read it, but.
I read it in the TU.
glad that somebody listens around this place.
Must be true.
It must be true. You know, yeah, it's something that the people over in athletic have been talking about for years, and I just think if you're going to have a new football stadium and you're playing in a new conference, the notion of not being the only member of that conference without a marching band, I think that's true. At least that's what the article alluded to. It's just not acceptable. And so I think it'll provide another opportunity and another mechanism by which we will be able to recruit students. Because I think we lose some students from not having an opportunity for those that may not want to major in music but who love playing. To have an outlet other than the pep band. Pep band does an amazing job. I complimented them throughout the whole basketball tournament this season. But so yes, that's what I read. Yeah, you read it the same time I did. So I'm glad that there is a very serious effort afoot to really put a band in place, and I think it's going to help tremendously, and hopefully improve the football experience on Saturday. So. Just a couple other things in closing. Commencement is upon us, as you all know, so I would like to invite all of you to participate. The university graduate commencement is scheduled for Saturday, May 18th, and we have an alumnus, Jack Hinion from the class of 92, will be providing the keynote address for the graduate school commencement ceremony, and he also will be receiving the semi-honorary degree as well. As part of that ceremony. He's a renowned scientist and innovator and co-founder and chairman of a leading biotech company called Epigenom. And I had a chance to talk to him on the phone a couple of times, and we're really excited about him being back on campus, so that should be an amazing graduation. Then on the following Sunday, we will have the university-wide undergraduate ceremony at on May 19th. We have the brothers, Monte Lippman, the class of 86, and Avery Lippman, the class of 88, will be delivering the undergraduate commencement address. If you are not into the music business, it probably doesn't mean much to you, but these two gentlemen are alums of the university. They are the president, chairman, and CEO, respectively, of Republic Records, which is a division of University Music Group, which is one of the largest, most influential music labels in the country, and they are also the exclusive record producer for the NBC TV program, The Voice. So if you don't know them by the artist that they produce, you probably would recognize them from producing the artist that made The Voice competition. So it is...
Maybe they'll fund the band. That's what I'm saying there.
Well, don't think we haven't thought about it. Yeah, I think it's something they can probably get their arms around.
Right.
Because they have a group of amazing big-time artists that are that label, with people like Nicki Minaj, for example. And anybody that knows contemporary music knows of her. And so these guys are really very, very successful and leaders in the music business. And so let's just say I think it's going to be an unusual graduation commencement address from them, So you'll have to come and experience it for yourself. I won't say any more than that, right, Kathy?
That's right.
All right. Come and experience it for yourself. So we're very excited about that. Just lastly, just wanted to inform you that the Medallion of the University will be bestowed upon Dan Thompson. And just want to take a moment to recognize Dan for his contributions to the university over his 16 years of service to the council, and the last six of that as vice chair. As you know, the medallion is the highest honor that a university can bestow upon an individual. And so we thought it was very, very appropriate to do this for Dan in recognition for his outstanding service to this university as a member of the council. So that's the end of my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Just a quick, two questions, that one related. Is that medallion, is that conferred at commencement, or is that a separate for the honor for Dan? At commencement. The second question is, we haven't signed up for commencement yet because we're late and didn't respond. Is it too late? Or?
Let me know.
Put me down and I'll check with them. Well, maybe not in that order.
I was just going to say, don't go in the opposite order.
Right. I'm pretty sure I'm good. I'll put me down. When I'm not, I'll send you an email.
Other questions, comments, remarks? You've been on a fact-finding tour, and I think it's amazing the number of people that I've run into that have said you were just there or you're just coming. I think it's amazing the number of places that you've been. At what point do you hold together some of those high-level thoughts on your observations of where you see the directional change or directional reinforcement?
Well, once we're scheduled to finish the last tour in June, and I've been promising people, you know, we're not just passing through to say hello. We will be looping back. We're taking notes and looking and jotting down really good opportunities to collaborate, and we will be looping back with those folks over the summer and definitely in the fall to go back and revisit the ones where we think we have a significant opportunity to drive a deeper collaboration. Our main goal there, as I said, is to make sure people understand that the University at Albany, even though the name is Albany, we want folks to understand that in Schenectady and Greene County and Washington County, that this is your university, and we want this place to be the top of the mind of the parents and students when they think about where they're going to go to university. And so we will have a formal way of, we've had, on each of these trips, I've been pleased to have probably no less than 10 and probably almost 20, 22 of my staff members from all various parts of the university who've been involved. And so some of those dialogues and partnerships are already going on, based on the folks that we had around the table who have a chance to interface directly with the relevant partner out there on these tours. And so some of it is ongoing, but we want to kind of synthesize all of that and be very intentional about the things that we're going to do, additional access. And we've heard a lot about the fact that almost every place we've gone, people have said that this is the first time that the president of the university has been there to have a conversation with them. And we want to make sure this is just more than just a conversation, that we leverage this to advance the university and our engagement and our partnership.
Any other questions before we move on?
Just a statement, just from the sports stuff, you know, the men and women are doing a great job, and the staff, and I applaud them. And I'm hearing more and more in the circles in New York City, more and more people are talking about the university. They're talking about, you know, this, oh, you guys are doing this there. And I think it's great. We have to continue, you know, with that side. And also, part of the strategy, of course, is then have them talk about the university for the university, all the other education aspects that we have. So,
absolutely.
You know, I encourage and will continue to do whatever you guys need to do to keep that message going. But the sports is definitely working, and the successes are definitely, going to be monetized in the way that we always thought they would be.
It's been a tremendous tremendous boost, I think, to the morale and to the visibility of the university, and we definitely plan to leverage that as a way to get an entree to further tell the rest of the story of the university about the other things that we're good at. We play basketball, both women and men, and and play some lacrosse, but we also have some outstanding academic programs, I think, too, that are poised to be the leaders in this country in those particular disciplines. So.
At this point, we normally would have the report of our student member, but I don't think Kevin Fox.
Fox is not here, but yeah. May I say something on behalf of?
I was going to introduce our new student member.
Hi.
Clara, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Clara Botvinnik. I'm originally from Brooklyn. I went to Middlewood High School. I'm a freshman, so I'm going to be a sophomore next year. And I'm a double major and a double minor in political. I'm a double major in political science and English. And I'm a double minor in psychology and philosophy, but I might be switching one of those to business. With my future, I basically want to go into corporate law. This summer, I'm going to be taking summer classes at my local college, and I'm going to be working for one of my father's friends in a law internship in the city, hopefully. I'm really excited to be on board. This is really interesting, and it's a great opportunity for me. I did a lot of like high school representatives, so it's nice to step up and then actually be able to work on a real council. Thank you for having me.
I think it's a tribute that Clara wanted to come to this meeting, even though her term doesn't start, because she wanted to dive right in and get a sense of this. So I think it's fantastic. Thank you.
Okay.
Chairman?
Yes, sir.
May I point out that Trey Price, who was a former student member of this council, has been elected to the student assembly for SUNY. He gets a permanent board on the SUNY Board of Trustees. And he'll have a swearing in on May 30th at the SUNY Plaza. So it's a Trey Price. He did an excellent job while he's here. And I'm sure he will represent the students very well on the Board of Trustees.
All right, we're going to move to our updates component of the meeting. Christine, the faculty update.
Sure, I can give a brief update. This is a very busy time faculty, of course, right during the final week. But I thought I would just give you an update on the Senate. The Senate has now elected new senators for, well, the colleges and schools have elected new senators to represent them on the University Senate for next year. We've also populated all the councils of the Senate that does the bulk of the work for Senate business. And the Senate has elected a new vice chair for next year. It's Joette Steffel Mabry from the College of Computing and Information Science. So she will be joining you on the University Council next year. And I think that's it.
Okay. Garrett.
So I'm going to give a very brief report on the status of the GSO, and then I'm going to move right into the more lengthy report that you all have in your packets materials. The quick rundown on where the GSO stands is that at the end of the year, not only have we managed to get ourselves out of the debt that we were left with after the last administration, but we've actually managed to set aside over $6,000 as a contingency budget, and we also have a reserve on top of that. So the next year's administration will be walking in with a lot better situation than we are, than we did. And the next administration has been elected. I'll be continuing in this post, but we have, but all our other officers are new. So. As far as the officer are concerned, we've opened an office in the downtown campus by where the political sign where the Rockefeller School is, and additionally, we finished our revisions to our constitution to make it coherent and properly functioning, and we should be able to finish updating our bylaws and rules going forward next year. We awarded 64 grants this year to students to fund trips to conferences and other things relating to their fields of study. And we've also funded 30 RGSOs for various events and conferences that they want to have. So that's the update on the GSO. Now, we're going to move on now to student debt levels, which is something we had previously discussed when discussing a little further under old business. But when this topic of discussion was first brought up several meetings ago, one of the things that was asked by the former president, Philip, was what role graduate students could play in terms of understanding this problem and addressing it. So at the least, we wanted to get our feet wet in terms of figuring out how graduate students see this problem and what are the realities of this problem from the perspective of graduate students. And to that effect, we composed a brief report in which we identified several areas beyond the issue of personal responsibility, which do contribute to student debt levels. And I know that personal responsibility is something we've harped on a lot around this table, but it's important to recognize that we've also got certain systemic issues which are contributing to student debt levels. So among these issues are issues of lack of financial literacy on the part of graduate students, which is something we all recognize, and it's a fact that a lot of graduate students and undergraduates and graduates like walk in without even being able to properly balance a checkbook, let alone calculate long-term interest rates, properly analyze loans, and so on. And this is something that the university, within its mission to provide an education, is very well proposed to attempt to address. Not only can we look at making available certain literature, but we can also make available courses and perhaps look at potentially weaving into the general education requirements that individuals have access to financial literacy as a means to fulfill one of those general education courses. It's impossible to cram this all into an advisement session. This really needs to be done over a semester with multiple credits, so that way an individual can have to take the time to digest this all. We also need to look at the way in which students can, if they've got a debt situation, can learn to manage their debt and be able to get it under control. This is often something that's beyond the understanding of an individual student. And they would frequently need advice. Let's face it, most of us, if we were in severe problems, would probably seek professional input in terms of managing our finances. But this is something that realistically, if a graduate student's in debt, there's no way they're going to be able to mobilize the resources to do it. So the university is in a position where that's probably something that the university could offer or find a partner to offer it with. And there are numerous agencies, we highlighted a couple in the report, that might be able to provide this. As far as web resources go, we've looked at the school's website, the way the school portrays information as far as finances, both in terms of what the student's personally responsible for, as well as other available information that will help the students get an idea as to where they can obtain loans, what the reasonable competitive prices are. And one of the things that it basically came down to is that while there is a fair amount of information there, it's not comprehensive enough. It's not comprehensible enough in that the average student can't understand, particularly if they're lacking the financial literacy background, but also it's not organized in an easy, coherent way. Let's face it, if anyone's ever tried to use the search engine on the University of Albany's website, they would understand they'll have better luck attempting to Google it using Google search engine openly. And that's a problem if a student is trying to look on the financial section of our website to find information on how to better their situation. But these are all questions about how students manage their debt based on once they're getting into it. Let's look at actual costs. The reality is that beyond the costs of our tuition and our living, our room and board, or if we're off campus, our rent and groceries, we also have ancillary costs we're dealing with. And these ancillary costs are related to the question of what courses you're taking, where you live, whether you live on campus or not, and these costs are non-trivial. If you're talking about taking a course, we all are very familiar with the cost of books, but one of the things that we don't accommodate for is the fact that increasingly professors are requesting that students use online homework grading systems and things like that. But a lot of people don't take into account is that these things have costs too. They'll frequently total hundreds of dollars, especially for a student who has to take multiple courses with this required. And that's something that it's not easy to accommodate for. And often students don't even find out that this is a required cost until they enter the course, where even if they'd already found out the book was required, they might have ordered a previous edition, which isn't going to give them any help in terms of getting access to these web tools. These things may not sound like a lot, being a couple of hundred dollars, but when you look at the total cost of being a graduate student in a given year, which is in the tens of thousands of dollars, that's percentage points. That's not a trivial number. So these are things that eventually add up. And I discuss a couple of other ancillary costs. We discuss a couple of our ancillary costs in this report, but I just wanted to look at that. And the university, if we look at these ancillary costs, maybe could look at policies by which we could control them. As far as billing and payment systems, I'm not going to go into great depth about that right now. There's a little more detail in the report. But the bottom line is that the billing and payment systems are often difficult for students to navigate, difficult for students to understand. And while the financial aid staff attempt and bursars attempts to be incredibly helpful, the reality is that it's often difficult, particularly with graduate students with convoluted schedules, to actually get a chance to make an appointment. Often the phones aren't answered, they're overwhelmed. They come in where there's such a long line that they can't feasibly wait long enough to get an appointment. Let's face it, a lot of graduate students have families and they're working and they have their obligations to their research. It makes it very, very difficult. There are methods which we could logistically lever the staff's time more effectively and be able to coordinate with students, that way a student can get an appointment to understand their problem and be able to address it. But ultimately, these are all looking at little numbers that add up to an increased burden. What's the baseline problem? The baseline problem, for at least from the graduate student perspective, comes down to assistantship levels. Don't want to go into a lot of numbers here because we do have a hard stop in mind, but I am going to point you very quickly over to page 16 in the packet. And a very quick look will show that not only is our school below the other university centers in terms of our compensation, we're also dramatically below what's considered to be the living wage in this county. And if you take into account, if you look at that and take that as a whole, and then you understand that number is not actually that number is the average among students that are funded, but there's a large number of unfunded PhD students and unfunded master's students, and then a lot more unfunded master's students. Many master's students don't actually have assistantships. And on top of that, of those who are funded, a lot of them are funded very significantly below this, often in four-digit numbers, not even over 10,000, you're looking at major problems. Debt is unavoidable. People are very frequently forced to take out loans on top of their assistantships. So quite simply, this isn't just a matter of a student's personal responsibility. The reality is that if we're talking about students getting more into debt as a cost of their education, if we want to address that, we need to offer a larger compensation package for the work that they're doing as part of their assistantship in order to make it so they don't need to take out these additional loans. Anyway.
Gary, do you have a list of specific recommendations, or is your group going to take, is that phase two of what you're going to provide, or this specific things that...
Well, we did recommend certain specific actions with respect to revising availability of information on websites, looking at different structure for that. We did recommend making available financial literacy courses and allowing them to count for gen eds, or alternatively offering them, at least if we aren't going to allow them to count for credits in the gen ed requirements, to at least make them free so that way students can willingly go to that. As far as the specifics on assistantships, we did not recommend a specific assistantship. Now, we understand that that's a very significant thing to bring up. But we thought it needed to be mentioned if we really want to understand the problem. But we did have specific recommendations as far as what we should do about addressing the issues of student financial literacy, the availability of information, and so on.
Questions?
Michael.
Just wanted to give you an update on the graduate student support. Obviously, we would love to be able to support students more. Graduate assistants actually aren't full-time employees. They're a 20-hour week employee, so you have to sort of divide that or multiply that number times two and to get to the minimum wage. Not that it's enough money, but just wanted to put that into context, that the graduate student support
comes... That's an excellent point. And actually, I thank you for bringing it up, because it's something that I forgot to mention. You're absolutely correct that the numbers on the contract specify that it's 20 hours a week, which would be you know, would be a lower salary, but it also specifies in there that you are not allowed legally to take another form of employment or another source of income while you maintain your assistantship in a lot of these agreements. So with that being said, even if we're looking at it as if it were a part-time compensation package, you can't divide it by two and then assume someone can fill out the extra hours with an additional pay source if they're required in order to keep this pay source to not get another form of employment.
Okay. I'm sorry, did you finish your comments?
I'm done, thanks.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Well, I think I have a question that Sue might be able to answer. To what extent are these online grading licensing being required, and is there a policy from the university?
I'm actually not familiar with a widespread use of online grading policies. We are required to post before the semester begins all of the required textbooks. So that's actually, we have to post it, though we work with the bookstore to do that. There are a number of courses in accounting that use a Pearson scoring system. I'm not sure that they require an additional cost, so it's a piece of information that will be useful for me to verify. I'm not aware of it being widespread, but it may happen in occasion. So.
So could you also comment on the fact that what percentage, we put in the form of a question, I assume that most, if not all, of our GAs and TAs get a tuition waiver as well of some kind?
Yes, they do. They get a stipend as well as a tuition scholarship. The tuition scholarship can range from a small number of credits to full dollars, depends on how many tuition dollars we've got available. We also have some of the assistantships are also quarter time. There are different amounts of time that are options. Most of our doctoral students are funded on state funds for their assistantship for the first 3 years if they come with a master's degree, 4 years if not. After that, they roll over onto typically onto sponsor funds, research activities. It's relatively rare for students in master's programs to have assistantships. It's not only rare for us, but it's rare for most of the universities.
So the number here, the $13,193, is a stipend number. It doesn't include the credits that a graduate assistant might get as well.
That's correct. They have however much the tuition is. If they're out of state, it's something like another 14.
And that's not included. So that number is not included.
Correct.
This is straight.
This is just the stipend. Right. This is. I mean, you can't take your tuition credits to the Hannaford.
It's not incurring.
Yeah.
It's expensive.
Yeah. This is an issue actually that had come up in the student forum. We have been working on increasing our stipends over the last several years. We do have some funds in 2020 to increase it further. We absolutely agree that we are not as competitive as we would like to be. Right now, our only alternative is to fund fewer students, which seems like a less good option. So.
Okay. If nothing else, we're going to move on. Attend the alumni report, and I see that you've got some very big shoes to fill, but we'll get to that a little bit later.
I'm still working on my divinity degree.
We'll pray for you.
Did you get a tuition
waiver?
Maybe. I thought I would just start by very briefly introducing myself. I'm a 1977 graduate of the graduate school, what used to be called the Graduate School of Public Affairs, now the Rockefeller College, of course. I was telling someone earlier, I came here when it was still located in Mohawk Tower, which is being torn down at the moment. So upon graduation, I went to work actually here at the university for about 5 years. I worked for doing program evaluation in the School of Social Welfare. Then I got a job in the state comptroller's office, and I worked there for 20 years doing financial analysis and policy research. I worked for Ned Regan and for Carl McCall, and I spent the last 10 years of my career running the Research Foundation at the State University at the System Office downtown. And then somehow or other, the Alumni Association found me and dragged me back to campus. So it was a pleasant discovery. I handed out our annual report. I won't take a lot of your time. I will just say that the Alumni Association continues its effort to find and develop more and more effective ways of engaging and reconnecting with both the current students on campus as well as the alums. And in doing so, we work very closely with the Office of Development here on campus and with President Jones's office and his predecessor. Just recently, a couple of weeks ago, we had our annual awards gala. We brought, 14 or 15 alums back who have been brilliantly successful in their careers. I thought it was a really good time. For those of you who were there, you have your own opinions of that, but I thought people really enjoyed themselves, and it was clear that the alums were thrilled to be getting some sort of recognition from a university that some of them left many decades ago and have been really, really successful. So it was a thrilling time for all of us. And with that, I'll answer any questions you might have.
Questions or comments? Well, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm going to take an item out of order because it may come into play today, and that's I'm going to drop down to 7D, a governance issue, and that's the election of officers. Steve, we need to elect two officers, correct? Steve, we need to elect the vice chair and what's the other officer?
And secretary.
So what I'm going to do is to hand out, this is just a list of, this is going to be a really informal election process. We don't have any auditors from Pete Marwin here.
You don't want to do that too?
First thing, I could. That I want to do, not that anybody would put their hand up, but the first thing I want to do is to ask if there's anybody that would like their name taken off the list for either vice chair or secretary. Is there anybody that would like to remove their name in consideration?
Yeah, I'm going to raise my hand.
Hey, Michael, this is Pat. Who's on the list?
Everybody.
It's the entire council.
Oh, okay.
So, Robbie, do you want to take
it? Only because I know that just my schedule won't work. Okay. I just wouldn't be able
good.
To fully.
Good. Is there anyone else? Okay, so then what I would like you to do over the next few minutes, not to put you under the spot now, but if you could just indicate on here who you would like to elect as vice chair and who you would like to elect as secretary and pass those back to me, if you would, and then I'll pass them to Steve. That's
how do you want to handle Pat?
She can email you,
okay,
or text you while she's online if she could.
Text.
That way we'll, because we may need a vice chair in another hour and 15 minutes. Okay? So do that as we're...
Okay, so who I'm supposed to email my choices for these?
To Steve.
Or text.
Or text.
I don't text.
All right.
Uh-oh.
Call him.
Okay, so we're going to move on while you're doing that. We're going to go to the financial aid and student debt presentation.
Don't want to hang up here. That's next, Michael.
I'm not going to do mine.
Electronics are out of my core competency, so I can't help with that.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. While we're working on our technical difficulties, I'm actually going to start the presentation. So
My name is Diane Corbin. I'm the Director of Financial Aid here at the University of Albany. I would like to first and foremost say good afternoon and thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I was invited to present to this group a couple of months ago now, I think. Up and running? Great. And I really welcome the opportunity because I was asked to come in and speak a little bit about financial aid and student indebtedness. And these are conversations that are being held across the nation. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't read at least one article on student debt. And I'm sure that many of you are in the same situation. It's a very important issue. It's a university-wide issue. It's a national issue. It is an individual student issue. So what I'm planning to do today is give you a summary, an overview of financial aid in terms of our students at UD Albany, so that you can get to know our students a little bit better in terms of financial aid and in terms of student debt and how we compare to the national averages in terms of student debt. So we're going to go through that. Again, I think this we've already taken some steps. We've taken steps to address the student indebtedness issue. I'll share those with you. And I think conversations like this will only be beneficial for us in terms of taking those next steps that are very necessary so that we can help our students and help the university at the same time. So how are we doing with our...
We just reset it.
There I am. So, again, national issue. I think we're all in agreement here. Student debt, top $1 trillion in student credit card debt. It's been all over the news, right? It's been on the Sunday morning news programs. It's everywhere. We certainly, in financial aid, have been very aware of this issue for a long time. We could see this building. We knew this was coming. This is something we've worked on, and we at the university, I think, have put some very good programs in place. We've dedicated a lot of resources to trying to tackle this issue, but it is an ongoing issue, and it is a national issue. It's happening everywhere. So student loan defaults are on the rise. We knew. What happened in 2007? What did we see? There's a chart that I have a little bit later in the presentation that will show you the default rates. That's not a surprise, I'm sure. But that's the reality of what we're facing right now in terms of the student debt, student loans, financial aid.
She's going to address the issue of the bankruptcy issue and those student loan defaults. In my world, this is a very hot item, right? Because right now, student loans are not dischargeable.
Right, exactly.
And there is a move afoot to make them dischargeable, which will make financial institutions either double the interest rate or just exit the market.
You know, it's very interesting. This is, when I say this is a national issue, as you all know, this is something Congress has been talking about, student loans. I mean, this has been going on for quite some time. Last summer at an orientation session for parents, I was talking with parents about, okay, we're not sure yet what's going to happen with the interest rate. We will know before July 1, and we found out at the 11th hour that those interest rates were going to be maintained on the subsidized Stafford loan. But that was not something that we all know what's happening in Congress. There's not a lot of consensus, shall we say, right now. So as a result of that, I mean, there's a lot of scrutiny, I can say that. And I think that's the first step in deciding what is beneficial for students. Is it opportunity for students to reorganize their loans, consolidate their loans? Should bankruptcy be an option? Those are issues that are being taken up at the national level. And our professional national organization, the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, does have a voice. I think it's very important for the financial aid community to have a voice and for students to have a voice.
Is there an official position of that group?
No. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been very involved with that issue because, you know, they really have been tackling that. You know, I think the concept, or at least the what our national organization has been putting forth is that the Higher Education Opportunity Act is the reauthorization is coming up, and they're saying, let's really take a look at all of this. Not that we want to blow it up and start over, but perhaps we really need to start thinking outside the box. And there's been some funding to allow different entities to do those kinds of studies. Yes?
Yeah, I think that some of the dialogues, again, decide now, because Elizabeth Warren put forth legislation, I think, is very interesting.
to see that the same thing you do in the banks. Otherwise, the banks are borrowing at 1.75. Why can't students do the same thing? And of course, that's, I think that the discussion has started. It takes us a little time to get going, but I think it's a good start. Now, where it goes from here, I don't know. Exactly.
Right, that's very difficult to say. Yes. Exactly. And it is a process, I agree with you. And that's when I say, well, we've known this. We could see this was coming. We could see those default rates. We knew what was happening. But, you know, to try to, and there are steps we have taken, but we knew that as a nation, really, Congress, in collaboration with universities and colleges and professional organizations and student organizations, need to get together to try to figure out a solution. There is no easy solution to this, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that's going to be helpful is that we have been pushing hard. We need to start with the pre-K kids. We used to do that. We used to have kids have savings accounts, teaching home loan management. We used to have, you could go and buy a bond at a bank. You can't do that anymore, savings bond, that kind of thing. So we're looking at that. It should be an integral part of the curriculum, because if you can make the money, you don't manage it, you're certainly going to lose it. And I think this is, it has to start, you know, and we need to continue to work on it. I think we're looking, too, at kids, which is helping them, as opposed to the large presentation, put them in smaller groups and have those kinds of discussions, I think, at home, because they really don't understand. I see often what the kids will do, they get the money, instead of putting on into record tuition or moving the pool, but they pay credit card bills, they buy phones, they do other kinds of things. That's because they simply have a lot, they borrow more money, and they never think in terms of how they're going to pay it back to the very end. I think that's very instructive.
And I will address some of those points as we go along, because I 100% agree with you. And that's why one of the priorities of my office has been outreach to the secondary schools. And we have been, I already had someone email me yesterday, can you come next week? So they're already planning their calendars, and they're reaching out to us at this point, which is great. A great opportunity. It's a win-win from my perspective. So, but I will talk about that a little bit more as we go along. I just want to give you a sense of who our students are in terms of financial aid. I think that's very important. So 80% of our undergraduates apply for need-based financial aid. That number is very, very, that percentage is very, very consistent from year to year. Our students are applying. That's the first step. We don't want anyone to be out there eligible for a federal Pell Grant and not applying for that federal Pell Grant. It's very important that they file the application. They're doing that. They're getting the message. So they're applying for financial aid. Average need of our applicants is $12,374 relative to our cost of attendance, which we'll talk about in a little bit. We have a fair amount of need at the University of Albany. Undergraduate financial aid applicants, 46% have incomes less than $50,000. We have very limited campus-based financial aid funds from the federal government. We put income thresholds on those funds because we know we cannot reach everyone. We have 46% of our FAFSA filers with income less than $50,000. Approximately 25% have a zero ESC. What does that mean? When a student files a FAFSA, a free application for federal student aid, it's put through a federal formula, and basically they receive an expected family contribution. Theoretically, that's the family's ability to pay. 10% of our aid applicants have a zero expected family contribution. That means theoretically they do not have the ability to pay anything towards college education. In fact, most of them do end up paying something or borrowing, because we are unable with the resources that we have to fully meet the needs of all of our students.
Are those statistics based on people that have been accepted to the university for applicants?
Those, can you go back up so we can look at that again? So the first undergraduate students apply for need-based financial aid. So we're looking at our undergraduate students. We do track data on the applicants.
But these are actually people
these are
that we
students.
Want.
These are our enrolled students.
Okay, thank you.
Federal Pell Grant is a federal grant, one of the largest federal grant, and for the highest need students. So it's a good indicator. It's a way to take the temperature of the university or of various universities that you can see to see what their population is in terms of financial need. University of Albany, 36% of our students receive Pell Grant. So that tells us that we have a very high need population here at the University of Albany. And that's just, you can see what the other schools, just give you some idea. Federal and state funding. This is no surprise to you either, I'm sure. Federal and state funding has tightened. Year-round Pell Grant. It's just, there was a Pell Grant for a while. There was just funding for Pell Grant where we could offer Pell Grant to students who were accelerating and attending school in the summer. That was eliminated. Number of semesters reduced. ACG Smart Grant, another federal grant program, eliminated. loan subsidies during the grace period for students who were eligible for a subsidized Stafford loan, eliminated. Subsidized graduate students, eliminated. Graduate TAF, it wasn't a lot, but it was a grant, eliminated. So as you can see, we've been dealing with more need. Our need is going up every year, and less money. The belt is tightening. We all know that. You all are not surprised by any belt. This slide I put in here because I think this is very important. Sometimes we think about, and we are very fortunate to have tuition this year, $5,570, very reasonable tuition, correct? That's for the academic year. So what we look for in terms of financial aid, or what we base financial aid eligibility on, is the total cost of attendance, which includes things like fees, room and board, books. When I say other educational expenses, those are things like travel, personal expenses, fees that a student would pay on a student loan in order to receive that loan. So we're talking a cost of attendance at the University of Albany about $21,500 next year. That's going up. We're not sure too. So actually a little bit higher. So these are all components of the cost of attendance. These are all educational costs. This is to give you a sense, quickly put this together so you have a sense of what some of our students and families are facing. So a first-year student, family four, $75,000 income. Net price, that's basically what is it costing that family after grants and scholarships. And you can see up here, I don't, you know, we'll read it all to you, but close to $21,000. There's a small TAF grant, SUNY tuition credit, which is our tuition dollars that are channeling back in to help those students with the increase in tuition. We're doing our part. Just there's not a lot available. Student borrowing, $5,500. So we know over four years that the tuition fee and the board is going to be increasing. But just assuming that remains the same, that family would be paying over $56,000 with $27,000 in student loans. This is another first year undergraduate scenario. Family of four with $40,000. You can see this family is eligible for a federal Pell Grant, is eligible for more at TAP. The SUNY tuition credit is higher, but so is the borrowing. The student has a work-study job, and the cost to the family after self-help, which is basically loans and work, which if we extrapolate over 4 years, close to $17,000 in payments for the family, $32,000 in loans. So how do they do this? You look at that picture and you say, well, that's not even doable. How do they attend the University of Albany? Well, federal parent plus loans. And we talk about interest rates. Very difficult to get up in front of a group of parents right now and say 7.9% fixed. So I certainly hope that this is addressed sooner rather than later. It just has to happen at the national level. Okay? It is a fixed rate interest loan. It is credit-based. We processed approximately $19.5 million this year in federal parent plus loans. There are protections built into the federal programs that are not necessarily available in the private student loan programs. So we recommend look at the federal loans first. So parents are also, and some of the articles that you're probably reading, I know the articles that I'm reading are talking about parent debt, right? But I want to admit I'm a baby boomer, but I'm a baby boomer. And when you think about the debt, I have a son in college. You think about that. It's becoming quite a national issue for the student and for the family. Private alternative loans. So some of the loans that we've referenced before, the private alternative loans. The interest rates tend to vary. Credit-based, again, so most of our students need co-signers for those loans. We process about $6.2 million. It's about, I would say, between 4 and 5% of our undergraduate population and probably 1.5% of our graduate population that turn to alternative loans, which is a relatively small population. We do try to steer our students towards federal loans first because of those protections, because of those, we'll talk a little bit about forgiveness programs and repayment plans that are available that are not necessarily available for private education loans. Families also need to be good consumers, and again, this goes back to the education piece, so that they know what they're borrowing, they know what the interest rates are. Interest rates are credit-based often with private alternative loans, but they will look at websites, see one particular interest rate thinks that that's going to be their interest rate for us, and really need to drill down a little bit more because it's based on their credit. Another point here, payment plans. So this is something the University of Albany offers, an 8-payment plan, 4 payments per semester. So I think Gary agrees with me on this one, but payment plans, I think, are a huge benefit to families. And that's because there is a fee associated with it. It's $45 at the University of Albany to participate in a payment plan.
Per payment?
Per $45 per semester payment plan, yes. So what that does, though, it allows the family, we bill twice a year, right, for each semester. They subtract their financial aid from their bill. They get the bottom line. If they can break that down into 4 payments per semester and figure out how much out of their monthly budget they can use to come up with toward that cost, in effect, reduces their borrowing. So this is something that I actually strongly encourage families to do. It just breaks it down into bite-sized pieces. They still have to borrow, but maybe they find that they can borrow $5,000 less than they originally thought that they had to borrow. So very important, I think, for them to be aware. We had a 2-payment per semester payment plan, wasn't as popular. This is much more, I think, beneficial to the families. And also 529 savings plans. These are other ways that families come up with, sometimes relatives, ways families come up with unmet financial need. So now if we get into student debt a little bit more, here you can see the national debt. We have the figures for 2011. So national 26.6 compared to UAlbany 23. So we are below the national average in terms of student debt. We did the calculation for 2012, it's 24. It is going up, but it is below the national average. We did a calculation of monthly payment. This is an estimate. It's based on a 10-year repayment plan, which is the minimum, 10 years. Students have options of longer repayment plans, which reduce their monthly payments. And we also used a 6.8% interest rate, which some students have loans that are less than that, 3.4%. So, but we were trying to give you an idea of what that monthly payment will be when they leave. You know, when our students leave after their undergraduate career, this is what their monthly payment may look like. So as you can see, 277 and 265 for last year. The cohort default rate. So the Department of Education provides our cohort default rate. We knew it was going to go up. We knew it was going to go up for a couple of reasons. One, because they were changing the calculation from a 2-year to a 3-year calculation. So inherent in that is an increase in your default rate. So we knew that was going to happen. It happened at the same time that our economy tanked, unfortunately. So defaults were on the rise. So the rates are on the rise, but the defaults are on the rise as well. So it's a perfect storm, so to speak. So you can see here our 2-year and 3-year cohort default rates for the University of Albany compared to the national average.
Do you know how we're doing, in that slide, with our peer group universities, say for the other SUNY University Center?
The other SUNY University Centers, I think we're slightly higher, but we also have a meager population.
Right.
So, you know, I almost blurted out the name of a private institution, but we have some of our local private institutions where they have a 1% default rate.
Right.
You know, but we also don't have a very needy population. Right. We have a very high needy population.
But they have a big endowment.
The end of
the
endowment.
The need can be met from endowment, which gets washed away in the numbers.
Right. This is a combination of factors, exactly.
How does the graduation rate play into all of this? I don't know what meeting I'm in, way too many meetings, none of which have to do with financial institutions. I was told that the graduation rate is somewhere in the 50%.
Range?
That is higher than for the university? Well, in general, the higher
national. National, four-year public, probably lower.
Under 50.
Yeah.
So people have debt, and they still don't have a degree that they pay for, right. Which I think
and those are the ones that
exacerbate
the risk. Exactly.
But you also know that in the SUNY system, they're spending $70 million a year tutoring kids. And as a result of that, they're not, in other words, they come into college and they're being tutored, It's not successful, so they leave now with nothing but debt, and which they cannot discharge. The other question I was going to ask was, would the parents know on any sign, cosign, that now that becomes their debt, and which in many cases they won't be retiring at 65 or 70?
Right. Right. With the parent cosign, the parent actually has to collect their own debt. They know they are the borrower. With the private alternative loans, there are, in fairness to the, certainly to the private lending institutions, there's been a lot of scrutiny, there's a lot of mandatory disclosure. So, I think that goes back to that whole financial literacy piece. You know, in some cases, there may be people that don't understand that, but certainly we try to help them understand that. Yes.
This is a blatant plea for personal advice because it's been the week my bank on this very subject. But since parents, if they co-sign, it's their debt anyway, do you advise parents who have the option of getting a less expensive loan, like you can get a home equity loan now, and using that in lieu of these 6.8 and 7.9, I haven't just know the figures off the top of my head for complicated reasons, but for a master's students who don't get any support from their institutions, also choose to go to private institutions, but do you advise that?
So I would never advise a family to take out a home equity loan. I give them the information, let them make the decision. I do that because, so think about it, if I had done that prior to 2008, you're putting your home up as collateral.
Right.
So that's, some families are very comfortable doing that. They've talked to their tax advisor, they're approaching it the right way. That's the only thing that I ask.
Or it is something that people do as a, to bring those costs that the payment.
Some people do choose that option, yes, absolutely.
Talk to your tax advisor.
No, I think we had the chart up there, but I think now I want to change directions just slightly and talk about how this is a university-wide issue. And this is what I referenced in the beginning, and I really, I know everyone in this room understands this. But funding for institutional grant need-based scholarships. I've gone on the road with Bardeen, which is a good thing, because we are out there trying to develop sources for need-based scholarships. Work programs are another option. Every dollar that a student earns or a dollar that a student receives in need-based financial aid is a dollar less that they're borrowing. So work programs, institutional grant and need-based scholarships, and again, we've certainly collaborated with the development folks on that. Cost containment, you all know about that. I don't need to. We're all doing everything we can. The state budget situation is what it is, right? So we're all working as best we can to contain costs. Financial literacy, huge. We need to make sure students understand before they sign on the dotted line, right? So one tiny example. There is no student at the University of Albany that should graduate and say, I didn't know I had a loan. Because we require that those students go in, even though we could actually have them say, file a FAFSA, we could get that loan through, boom, apply it to their student account, and it would be dispersed, and they would owe that money back. We don't do that. We have them file the FAFSA, and then we have them go into MyU Albany, and they tell us, yes, I would like to accept my loan. No, I want to decline my loan. I would like to accept a portion of my loan. We do not make any assumptions when it comes to student loans, because we want those students to understand that they are borrowing. And there are several other steps as well, but that's just one example. Tied to degree. And I know this is something that everyone on campus is aware of, because I talk with my colleagues and they'll say, oh yes, we're having conversations about that. So certainly if students are borrowing and then they're taking an extra couple of years to finish their degree, they're going to be borrowing more. So time to degree is huge. And that's also something that is campus is very aware of, and certainly it was a collaborative effort to work with students on that. Early awareness. Outreach efforts, huge. So just a couple of examples. We have SUNY Financial Aid Day. We go into high schools. I think we had about 20 to 25 events last year where we went into high schools. I had one guidance counselor last year say, do we really talk to our middle schoolers? Because we typically talk with juniors and seniors. Would you come in and talk with our middle schoolers? Absolutely, we would do that. We'd be happy to do that. So getting the message out early on, helping them understand what's available so that they can make informed decisions. Because the decision ultimately is going to reside with the student and the family. But if we can help them make informed decisions, that's key. Go ahead to the next slide. engaging the entire university in fall prevention through retention and student success. And the provost has been the lead on this. I think that we, you know, we could set best practices for SUNY on this. You know, I've seen a report that I think Bob compiled on this. I mean, we have some programs that are just phenomenal. The PALS program is a new program this term. I've got to be a mentor for a student. I mean, these are programs that help students become successful so that they're not in a situation where those students are then leaving school with debt, no degree. You know, we want them to be successful. Again, financial literacy default SUNY award letter. This is all part of the Chancellor SUNY Smart Track Financial Aid Initiative, of which we are a pilot school. So we are the only university center that is a pilot school. They called us, asked if we were interested, and we said, yes, we are. So these are the components of the SUNY Smart Track program. Financial literacy, my staff's been involved in actually doing some of the review with vendors in terms of financial literacy. The couple that you mentioned in your report have been in here. We have reviewed their products. So this is something that will be launched fall of 2013. That's SUNY's goal. It will be SUNY-wide. So we will be, it'll be on our website, but essentially we will be linking to a vendor that SUNY will be provide. Well, SUNY will offer be able to take advantage of that financial literacy product. Default diversion, and also a SUNY award letter, which was new this year. Shopping sheet. I don't know if any of you have heard of the shopping sheet or done any reading on that. So at the federal level, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Department of Education got together and said, we need to make college costs and financial aid more transparent for students and families. The chancellor was involved. SUNY is an early adopter. Not only did we adopt the shopping sheet as an information, as a supplement to a financial aid award letter, but we actually adopted as a financial aid award letter. And I'm very proud to say that the University of Albany, for our new undergraduate students, they all received the SUNY financial aid award letter, which is in the shopping sheet format, the third week in March. So we were one of the first ones out the door with that. That discloses all costs, it breaks down the cost, it gives the student the net cost, it gives the students clearly delineates loans and work, separate from any type of grants and scholarships. We adopted it as an award letter for 13-14. We'll roll it out to our returning students and graduate students in the upcoming award year, 14-15. Managing debt. This is the other piece. So as the students go out the door, helping them understand, if you're an undergraduate, you're graduating, going on to graduate school, your loan, if you're registered at least half time, your loan, you can apply for deferment for your loan. Loan forgiveness programs that are available to students for the federal student loan. Repayment options, many repayment options. I had the pleasure of being on CBS 6 Answer Team about a week ago, May 1st, and I'll tell you, many of the questions were, what do I do? How do I repay my student loan? What are my options? There's a great federal site on the studentaid.ed.gov website. It gives the various repayment options, pay as you earn, pay as you owe. We're all hearing about this. We're hearing about the possibility of loans being taken out of paychecks eventually. All of this is being proposed at the federal level. But there are repayment options available to students now to help them now. So this is just getting this information to the students. So I've talked really fast, but I apologize for that. I was thinking of that plane.
No, I appreciate it.
You know, one thing I want to be clear on is student loans are not the bad player here. Student loans provide access to many, many of our students. I think a student loan is the best investment I ever made, to be honest with you, much better than my car or my house or anything else. So it certainly is, it's a pathway to education. It provides access to student loans. But what we need to do is we need to make sure that we're out there, as we are with that shopping sheet, as we are with the SUNY Smart Track program, as we are going into the high schools, and helping students and families understand responsible borrowing, which loans are better, the best options to take, combining loans with grants and work, and helping them realize when they decide what school they're going to attend, whether or not it's an affordable option for them. The University at Albany, a quality education at a great value. I truly believe this. This is a world within reach here. And if our students reach out and grab it, they have it right at their fingertips. And they have it at a great value. So this is something that, is there more work to do? Absolutely there's more work to do. But I think we're well on our way to helping our students and helping to address this problem of national debt. And I certainly would be happy to meet with anyone. You certainly have my contact information if anyone has any additional ideas. I've already talked with Gary, and he and I've met some of my colleagues at Student Financial Services. We are going to meet together to hear his perspective on some things. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Questions?
Thank you. Questions?
Actually, this might be for the provost. How will online courses hold down costs and increase time to completion?
It's one of the chancellor's goals in her Open SUNY initiative is to use online courses as a way to accelerate the number of courses that you can take in a year. So instead of taking 10, you take 15. So you take additional ones during winter session, during summer session, and so on. So that you don't take fewer credits, you don't log fewer hours of learning, but you do potentially accelerate because you use more of your time in the day and time in the year to finish a degree. So conceivably, you could take the fourth year of an undergraduate program, 10 courses, and spread out those 10 courses over the prior 3 years, taking a winter course and 2 summer courses each of the prior 3 years, or you could be done in 3 years. Have to work winters and summers.
That's actually very interesting. I want to ask another question following up that one. How does that how is the payment for those courses structured? Is it still the same per credit, in which case it's still going to total the same amount? It's just going to be less interest accrued because of a shorter period. But
There's a discussion going on right now at SUNY about the cost of an online credit. Right now, our online courses cost the same as any other course. So, of course. Empire State College does it a little differently. Some other parts of SUNY do it a little differently. In theory, we're all offering the same credits for the same tuition, but so SUNY has taken up the question. So, right now, for us, it is the same dollars. So, it would be just accrued faster and.
I think in selling this, that students should understand too that this knowledge is going to be beneficial for the rest of their lives. Because when many times when they get into a position, take a job or whatever, that many of these new companies do not, many companies do not have a retirement program. So you have to invest in 401k. So you've got to have a knowledge of that. And if you don't, then you're going to end up with another problem. So I think it's a several lines.
I think it's great. And I think this generation is really they're starting to wake up, but we need to help them along the way. I think that's key. So, I mean, they're realizing, I hear young people talk about retirement plans. They know there's going to be nothing out there necessarily, that they have to take action themselves.
But they have to think about it.
And there's outstanding questions now at high school nights about related occupations. And the federal government has the federal scorecard that's out there where they are going to be providing information on occupations and your potential earnings. It's a little scary because we know education for education's sake is a great value, to not only to the individual but to society overall. But so if you look at the University of Albany and look at those payments, you could be a teacher and you could make that payment, even if your salary is not, you know, to a level that an engineer, where it might be for an engineer. So those are the types of conversations that are, the parents are asking at high school financial aid, which I think is really a good thing. So, maybe a couple other questions?
Well, we're running out of time. I just want to make one point, though, that I think part of this financial aid story that's very presented, and that is the number of students on our campus that actually receive Pell, that are Pell eligible.
Yes.
And as you know, that's one of the pieces of that's going on at the national or federal level about the sustainability of the Pell program. Folks, if that goes away, then we're in serious trouble in terms of how we're going to be able to finance the education of more than a third of our students, 36%, I think.
36%.
That's a big issue.
Question.
And so whenever that issue comes up in your dinner conversations or your conversation with legislators, make sure you remind them that this is not just a a negative decision in that regard will have dire consequences to most of our education. Because I can tell you, a lot of our peer institutions, I was at a meeting at the Gates Foundation about 2.5 weeks ago, and there were 24 presidents of urban universities, and they asked all the presidents that had more than 50% of their students that were Pell eligible. And I'm willing to bet you almost 75% of the folks in the room hands went up. So it's a big issue.
I think that's important for us as we determine what is our role, and clearly lobbying, not official lobbying, but certainly those communications with the decision makers is something where we can certainly make an impact. We don't want to sit back and look at this and wait for the next report. We need to be proactive. Thank you. That was great. That was great.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you.
To keep everybody off track, I'm going to go off script again. I have three other items of old business that I want to hit really quickly. Primarily logistics. We need to set next year's meeting schedule, so I just want to get people's opinion, and then we can get some dates out to you. Usually early October, early December, late February, early May. Does that still work for people? And the issue of the Friday meeting, is that still the group's preference?
Yeah, I think
no. All right, and there was some talk, tongue-in-cheek, last meeting about do all of those meetings happen here? Is there ever an occasion to have a meeting downstate? Was that just fun and games, or was that a serious suggestion?
It would be great, but, you know, self-serving statement. But no problem coming up to the university. It's always
great. If you have a strong opinion,
I'm embarrassed to say that I'm always happy to go to Albany, even though I didn't make it today.
Okay. All right, if you have a strong feeling on that, please email Steve and I if you would. Last meeting, if you recall, we talked about needing two or three volunteers to look at the draft student conduct code and work with the student success people. I'm looking for people who would be willing to volunteer for that.
I will volunteer.
Okay, could we have two other people? Okay, anybody else? Perfect. You guys are good.
Mike, Abner, and Gary.
Yep.
The last item of administrative business is the whole concept of a council retreat that's still hanging out there. Robert, we don't want to, we really want to defer to you as to when you would like us to move in that direction. So, not that I'm looking for a decision now, but I just don't want it to leave the table. So, you know, at some point we need to resolve that issue.
Absolutely.
Okay, fantastic. Back on schedule, item 7, new business, you all be online.
Give me just enough time to get the PowerPoint up. Thank you. There's a request from the council to speak to the progress that Albany is making in our online courses. You cannot open the paper to New York Times, Chronicle of Higher Education, probably the Times Union, without hearing about something online, particularly having to do with MOOCs and having openly online courses. Or blended learning, or any number of other options for online. So I wanted today to give you just a quick briefing of where we have been online teaching and learning here at UAlbany. Give you some SUNY context that you'll hear about a bit that I mentioned before, the national context, what we've been doing this semester to set a new strategic direction, and to talk a little bit about our next steps that are coming up. So when I start this, our strategic plan, as you know, has included a number of options for us to consider the ways in which we teach and the access that we provide to students. We included more strategic and intentional expansion of online opportunities as one of our strategic plan objectives. We recognize that the access to UAlbany can be expanded. We have an obligation for access, and we can expand it through online teaching and learning, particularly to professional adult continuing education non-traditional students. Students are coming to us with online experiences. This is the digital native generation. They live through their fingertips and through their thumbs, bringing our educational experience into line with that. And we want to make sure that we have good options for the high ability student in an increasingly competitive environment. My shorthand version of that is there's no way that we can't
do more online. So our recent history at UAlbany, we actually were ahead of the curve in the early 1990s. We developed one of the first fully online programs in SUNY. It's a master's program in reading. That actually continues to exist to this day. We added to that four additional online graduate programs. You see them listed there in the Berlin Education. We just added the Master of Public Health last year. And we've just added two new graduate certificates, one in online teaching and learning, and one in public health. So those are most of the graduate work. If I give you some feel for where we've been going, graduate and undergraduate, over the last, since the end of the 90s, you can see that we've been growing quite steadily. Undergraduate, the blue line, has been growing dramatically in the last couple of years, and I'll tell you why that is. If you extend that out to the 2012-13 year, which isn't fully complete yet, you'll find that 146 has now gone up to 158 for undergraduate courses, and the graduate course has gone from 100 to 122. So the growth is continuing at this time. What accounts for that spike in the blue line there is summer and winter sessions, where we have been working on developing, using that as a vehicle to develop online courses, particularly courses that meet the general education requirements. And so, just to give you a feel for what we've been doing the last couple of years, this winter, the winter session is between the time the lights go out in December and the time that we start out class in January. We've offered 65 courses, 58 of them are undergraduate, that GE is 44 of those meet the general education requirement, and seven of them being graduate. You can see the summer session courses as well. These courses filled up very quickly. This was actually the brainchild of an idea to make use of the fact that the student was home, could spend some time profitably learning, and it would be much better if they learned with us rather than their institution next door back home. So we set up a way to capture that.
So why the cap on enrollment?
Pardon me?
You said they fill up quickly.
They fill up quickly. Currently, our model for online courses is not a MOOC model. It is actually a very fairly labor-intensive model. For teaching, we have a current cap of around 20 or 25 per class. Very intensive instruction. We're looking to grow, as you'll hear later on, grow the capacity for 100 or 200 level classes. It'll require bringing in some more TA assistants to participate in that. Anybody who thinks that the online course can be done with fewer instructional capacity is haven't taken a MOOC yet. So it isn't a cost savings measure to the university. It's actually a cost increase.
Are these blended models?
These that I'm mentioning here are fully online. We also have probably about 20 blended courses. I'll just skip forward a slide and let you know that in the mid-2006, I think, we had a grant from the Sloan Foundation, which, as many of you know, is the online maven of corporations. We had a grant from the Sloan Foundation to increase our capacity in being able to teach a blended course. Blended courses are taught partly on ground, partly online, and every school and college participated in that, started in education. We roped in social welfare, public health, CAS, and beyond. Right now, the courses that are offered in blended fashion, again, apart from these numbers, are probably primarily in education and social welfare right now. A lot of interest in that, though, a lot of interest in increasing that capacity, and frankly, much more comfort on the part of faculty in beginning to teach online, to do it in a blended way.
How do you imagine the future that blended courses specifically are going to interface in terms of introductory level, like our 100, 200, the ones that have lecture centers are filled with 300 students, where the students in the back may as well be looking at a computer screen because they're not able to interact, but then they have the little lab groups, which are 20 so people.
Yeah, let me talk to you about a little bit later about flipped classrooms, because we're doing some of those also, and that's one of the strategies of dealing with that. Those are simply the numbers. Just some other backgrounds. This is the Sloan Foundation grant that I mentioned.
We've also, even during the budget crises, Information Technology Services continued to add to its staff for programs and staff help to help faculty learn to develop courses and teach them online. We also have just recently funded a flipped classroom initiative. We have six reports I've already seen of faculty who have participated in a, so how do you flip a classroom and what does it look like? Results vary. First time we've tried it, we've got another six coming online. I haven't seen the reports yet. Typically, the faculty are not only changing the venue in which they teach, but they also end up changing how they teach. That's always a rough lift on the first time through, but very satisfying as it goes along.
I'm confused. I don't understand. What's
a flipped classroom? A flipped classroom is when, let's see, the traditional way of teaching, you go to the lecture center, you listen to a lecture, you go home and do reading, and do a problem set, and you turn it in and you repeat. So in a flipped classroom, you go home and you listen to the lecture on a video capture at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you come to class and you do the problem set in an interactive setting where you're doing engaged learning. So it's just completely flipping it back and forth. What it does is make most use of that active learning, engaged learning concept that is so effective for any kind of learning, and puts it in the classroom. It's very interesting. It also makes for not so much a need for a 500-person classroom, because you can do that online. 500 people can watch the video. And then you have five TAs working with different groups as they come in for their interactive learning opportunity. We've also had, we've just had our very first fully online undergraduate program approved by SUNY for development. SUNY has a high needs program in which they fund the development of programs in which there is a seen need across the state. We submitted two programs. One of them was offering a complete bachelor's degree entirely online in information technology. So buckle up. In another year, I'll tell you how that's going to work.
As an employer, I can't imagine what happens to that whole social component that most of these kids are coming out lacking. The entire thing is online. That scares me that they will be unable to communicate.
I have some comfort to offer you for that in a moment. That's a concern.
Are we going to do athletic practices that way?
Frankly, the chancellor has proposed to offer internships and engaged learning co-ops field placements entirely online.
Wow. I got to tell you that, and maybe we're old school, but there's a certain semblance of going to school that you want your kids to learn about, which is social interaction.
I'm sorry, I can't hear who's speaking.
It's John Fallon, sorry. There's this whole social interaction that's missing here, and that is when we send our kids to school, I mean, my kids are kind of young, but when they go, hopefully I'll still be around. You'll want them to interact with other kids that they've never interacted with. I mean, these are two Upper East Side kids. We'll be interacting with kids from other parts of the country, with other parts of the state, different kinds of kids that are outside of the milieu that they've been in. And, I have a 7 and 11-year-old. So are you telling me that by the time Kylie goes to school, let alone Jack, we're going to be in a situation where this is occurring? And you think to yourself, yeah, maybe you save some dough on room and board, but I got to tell you that this is not what we are going to, we should be going for on a total basis.
Yeah, there are two perspectives to offer in this that may give you some degree of comfort. Three. The first one is that when you imagine the access to higher education for somebody who is working during the day, has kids that they need to address at night, and their time opportunity for higher education is between 3 and 5 in the morning, this is the option that would be perfect for them. They wouldn't be able to do it.
I don't disagree.
So there's,
I really
there's
don't.
That
However,
as a
However, I can tell you that what's going to happen here, and I, this is a business person speaking with folks that work for me at a younger age, this is all going to morph into everybody doing it, as opposed to simply the people that you're identifying correctly with folks that work, older people that have second jobs and all that. I get that. I really do. And I like the idea of the winter part and the summer part, because we don't have the ability to keep this place open 24/7, 365, right? However, I wonder whether there has to be some rules put into place that require a certain amount of time has to be physically spent on campus in classes, as opposed to some kid getting away, right, with 100% of their credits being online, and he's just sitting in some dorm room somewhere going online.
Yeah. Or
at home.
Or worse, and at aptitude. You know, again, to me, as a business person, and I understand that's not always the right lens to look through, but this is all about preparing kids for the working world. Right. So is there some evaluation of aptitude when they leave on those social skills? Because even before this, we're seeing that is the biggest thing that is lacking today because of all of this stuff. And so to take it even further, they gravitate to that. I have a 16 and a 19-year-old. If my 19-year-old had that option, she would never see the inside of a classroom, and then she would be socially handicapped on the back end. That's what my concern is.
The concerns that
so
you
I'm
going to
second that as an employer. I mean, I think there's already a problem with communication skills, even if kids have been, you know, on campus. I mean, we're seeing a real issue of inability to write well, speak well, interact with all kinds of people that you have to. And things like, as well, lab courses. How do you take a lab course online? How are we going to... if we have this great need for STEM majors, they need hands-on laboratory experience, you know, hands-on, you know, testing kinds of things. And so I personally can't imagine hiring somebody that only, you know, has an online degree. But I think it's, you know, I think it's a problem, and I think it's already a problem with the, you know, that computers have maybe taken over a little bit too much.
I got kids that can't write, is what it comes down to. And
yeah.
They look at these documents.
I'm tired
you
of hearing what the computer says. 300-page
document.
Wrong.
And all they do is they screen it all up. And I tell them, print it out, read it, hand mark it up, and believe me, you'll understand it a lot better than if you just sit there with that screen constantly doing the screen thing. It just doesn't work. And you can spell check and all this nonsense. I tell my own daughter this. That you have to print it out, you have to physically mark it up, and you'll learn and understand it a lot better.
I'm embarrassed to say we're morphing to them. You know, I'm now tweeting in 142 characters that aren't solid sentences, and I just don't think, I think it's going to present a problem.
Half an hour ago, we were talking about graduate students not understanding basic algebra. And you know, stuff they should have learned in middle school. They can't calculate interest expense. They don't understand debt payments. I mean, these are basic, you know, whatever. I don't even know when kids take algebra now, but it sure isn't in graduate school. It's, you know, it's like eighth grade or ninth grade.
Well, and I agree with, like, everything a lot of people said, but I think what we fundamentally have to understand here is that there's a few distinct problems that we're seeing. And yes, maybe technology to some degree has agitated these problems by making people think they can always go to a search engine and pull the basic knowledge necessary for life. And we all know that's not true. But the reality is that at some point in the near future, we're going to be competing with schools who are offering high-level degrees in a, if not completely online, a mostly online format. And while we do agree that there's some definite weaknesses in the ability to impart these necessary social skills as well as the interactions that help to achieve a mastery, I think that with this program, what we're seeing here is we have an opportunity to really lay the framework and develop an understanding for how to hybridize our in-person, on-campus experience with the capabilities of online technology to leverage both more effectively. And I think that we should view this as an opportunity rather than a disaster. It's an opportunity to control the way forward.
I'm not saying it's a disaster. All I'm saying is, I think we're all saying, that this is simply another example of something that has to be carefully looked at before the train leaves the station and we can't fix it later. And all I'm saying is there should be some semblance of, you know, discussion or whatever put in place to have a balancing act between online. For example, kids can't have a certain amount of online credits beyond a certain amount. Others have to be in
the same rules, for instance, taking courses at another college.
Again, I'm just saying that there's ways to fix this.
But I think what you have to understand, too, is that the debate that we're having, the discussion we're having now, is that it's going on throughout the country precisely for the reason that you're saying. So that's why I mentioned earlier about blending, the blended learning, because for those of us who are traditional teachers, is that when you're instructing in front of a class, you can adjust your instruction based on how the students are reacting to you or you to them, whatever the situation, make an adjustment. And whereas when you're looking at a camera, and that's what you're doing, that can be a problem. But I think that, so this discussion that we're having is going on, I guarantee you, throughout the country to try and decide what is the better approach. And I think in time, if we keep working at it, we'll get to some kind of agreement and because there's no stopping it now. It's started now how to correct. The same thing with texting is that the texting to me has destroyed, in many cases, the ability to reinforce writing. And we all know that reading and writing are judicious. You have to practice. You have to go over. And you were talking about editing. Many times what they'll do something, turn it right in, never look at it again.
That's
a problem. You know, so since we're aware of it, we have to have these discussions so we can get to a point where we will be able to make certain adjustments and move forward.
And I would just add to what Dr. saying and to what you're saying, that there's a natural weeding out process, because if any of you have sat for one of these online courses, it takes discipline. So right there, Wooshka, most of the students that we would take, I'm going to be gone. So it would leave a different tranche of type of person that would do that. Now, notwithstanding what I just said, they still have to go through all the screens that you said, and there's concerns in that. But it's dynamic. But I think it's a good movement.
I think a good example of that, and I don't recall the exact number, but they've done a study of the number of people that actually sign up for these MOOCs. There's hundreds of thousands of folks that sign up, but very few that actually complete the course.
It's hard, because the only person they're pushing is you.
So let me tell you a little bit more about what we're doing.
We already figured it out.
So. You'll be, I think, reassured by our approach and strategy to the challenges of online learning. The kinds of questions that you have posed and concerns that you've raised are the ones that are out there in the literature on the conversation. The only one you didn't mention was the one about integrity. How do we know that this student is teaching this and taking this class? But those are swirling as well. As it happens, we happen to have on the campus actually one of the world's experts on online teaching and learning, and so we're using him. This is Peter Shea in the School of Education, he is helping us to shape a strategic vision and to be able to design what the research needs to be so that we know what happens to a kid. We've also managed to include in the Chancellor's vision on online learning the necessity to have research on teaching online learning. Yay! So many of the discussions that you have brought up about the fully online degree are ones that we have been trying to tackle with. It's raised questions about, so what is the value of the residential experience and how do we prize that and make sure that we do it intentionally? What is the best way to teach online? How do you engage somebody so that they don't drop out? What is it? It isn't just scrolling through words. How do you engage people in ways that aren't cheatable and that are learning additional? And how do you create a way for interaction and community to build, because we know in learning communities on campus that's the best way of learning. So how do we do that online as well? So all of those are questions. We have some answers, not all of them yet. To give you
Could you just pacify me by saying at some point you're going to consider the needs of employers
Oh, you bet.
In that whole thing.
You bet.
See, I think employers will drive the market in the end anyway.
We would never hire somebody that had an
online. Because if you look at the history of innovative educational movements, many times they failed because employers responded. So in the end, I think you all are in the driver's seat.
Undergraduate or graduate?
Undergraduate.
Okay.
Interestingly, just to take a little side tour with you into the employer perspective, it is indeed the interest of the employers that is driving the MOOCs. With the idea that an employer really can't tell what a student has learned in a bachelor's in Levia, but if they had a badge that said this person has learned this particular skill, then they would have greater confidence in who they were hiring. And so one of the ways that, in fact, MOOCs are intended to be monetized is to be able to offer MOOCs in badge-worthy ways that employers could then use to make employment decisions.
Additional credentials.
Thanks. Anyway, so...
While you're taking a breath, and I sincerely apologize, but I do have a plane to catch. So I want to introduce the vice chair. That's Pierre. And Pat is our secretary, and I'm going to ask that you would continue the rest of the meeting, and you know, you get a couple of things here to do. And again, I apologize, but divorce court is a very expensive place to be.
Motion to adjourn.
You put five pieces of paper in the ballot there, so it's two of one.
I took two out.
No, the ballots are now impounded.
So I promised you, as Mike said, I promised you the vision from SUNY, as well as a picture from online, and then a revisit of what we're doing on this campus. And I think that you'll find yourself a bit more reassured when we come to the end of the conversation. Just a quick view of what's happening at the other SUNY centers. This is as of last year. Stony Brook is definitely moving forward ahead of anybody else in terms of the online courses. You can see their enrollment online is both undergraduate and graduate. Ours is much more graduate, and as you see, Binghamton is not doing much. This doesn't show you the community college online offerings, which are pretty large in terms of the general education requirements and the offerings of Empire State College, which are widely online. I remind you that any of those courses is transferable anywhere in the system. And so a course may come to us, a student having taken a course at Oneonta online, we wouldn't even know it was online. There is a cross SUNY system transfer ability that allows students to seamlessly transfer and to do that with online courses as well. Give you a sense of what is cooking at Open SUNY. This is the Chancellor's initiative announced in her State of the University agenda this last January. It's bigger than what I put here. There's many more fish in her frying pan. But the pieces related to online teaching and learning in particular are about potentially improving degree completion and time to degree by taking more courses more quickly, including ways to develop and deliver a targeted set of online degrees. The IT degree was something very attractive to them because it is a high-needs area. They'd like to be able to provide that kind of degree and provide greater access to that degree across New York State to respond to employer needs, actually. They want to scale up innovation and research in teaching online. This was the real gift to us because we have expertise in research on online teaching and learning. We made sure that was in there. So as SUNY goes forward with their initiative on expanding their online offerings, we'll be there tracking what it is, how it works, how well it works, how we can do it better. You can also see here the note of providing a robust set of federated services and infrastructure. What that means is that SUNY, which has an entity called SUNY Online, the SUNY Learning Network, is intended to ramp up capacity so that each campus doesn't have to build their own. There are some different views on whether this is a good thing, but it certainly provides a central service with a good deal of experience. It also intends to provide some workforce development programs, particularly for the workforce areas that the state has identified. So that's SUNY. SUNY has definitely got their foot on the accelerator. it's happening nationally. To give you a feel for this, this is a survey from 2010, the Babson survey, and what it tells you, bottom line, is that the rate of online enrollment growth is just massively greater than even the rate of going to higher education growth. So the growth is between 10 and 36% annually online and less than 4% annually on ground. 31% of students take a course online, and at any given time there are 6 million students enrolled in an online course. One of the concerns that I mentioned earlier that people are talking about quality and integrity. Certainly social interaction is another concern that comes up, as well as the adequacy of technology, where making it, you can only do access if you have the electricity and tools to make it work. So we took a look at where we had been, where SUNY was, where the nation was, decided it was time for us to take stock in where we were now and where we wanted to go forward. We formed a strategic planning working group for this year. It included 40 faculty and staff in four different groups. We used the Sloan report card, which is the report card that says how good is your institution at being prepared to do quality online education. We divided up into four areas. One is a shared vision of online teaching and learning. One is what kind of resources we needed to give faculty. Second, what kind of student support and engagement was needed. How do you do this for an online student, as you've asked. And one was how we ensured the technology support. So these are the four working groups that have been working along the way. We've reviewed our status in relation to the scorecard. The preliminary recommendations that came out of this are first, that we're not the University of Phoenix. It doesn't say that quite online, but that's what that means, is that there has to be a clear mission for teaching online, teaching and learning online at UAlbany, and it has to recognize our distinct characteristics. It has to be a high-quality experience, it has to pay attention to access, and it has to recognize that we're a research institution. That was my short version is we're not the University of Phoenix.
Just being the ignorant one on this, in the academic circles, that statement, I know you're tongue-in-cheek, what do the academicians view the University of Phoenix? Is that just like drive up like a McDonald's type of place? I mean, or do you look at it like with distinction?
It depends on which academic you're speaking to.
Well, I'm talking in this context of online learning.
University of Phoenix started their work focused on students with a particular employer need. That was where they started their work. And they designed programs and courses to fit around their work schedule. That led to the university offering online courses. It's very automated. They're extremely good at it. They have student services down pat. They have financial aid down pat. I'm not sure that they make anybody sign anything on that, but they've done a remarkable job at focusing their resources, focusing their faculty, and offering what they saw employers would need. When it was doing that, it was actually seen as a very innovative distance learning opportunity for providing access to needed degrees. They expanded to broader initiatives, and even they will say that they kind of faltered in that. Their students weren't as prepared to study online. They weren't quite as focused. They weren't quite as pressed into a particular initiative. And as they expanded their opportunities, much of the nonprofit or public higher education, or even the private nonprofit, have sort of, you know, raised their hands on their hips and been very concerned. And that's happened at the same time that there has been an increasing concern about the practices of the for-profit institutions in terms of financial aid, recruitment of students, not telling them what their options are. All of the things that you hear about the shopping sheet, what's going to happen on the other side of this degree, are all come out of the for-profit, some of the shiftier practices of for-profit. I wouldn't say that University of Phoenix itself is a shifty practice. There are a lot worse places than that, but its reputation has had some real dents in it because of its expansion to a larger. They actually now they require every student now to take a no-cost pre-course course in how to learn online so that the kid knows what they're getting into before they do it, in the interests of that buyer beware, know what you're getting. So I can't say that all of the they do. They have physical locations around the country,
right,
actually around the world.
Highways, big letters.
Right, they actually around the world. They just finished their version of the Middle States accreditation. They've got a different accreditor, but their institutional accreditation, and the accreditation site visit process took 2 years because they had to go to like 20 different countries and 10 different. They're probably going to end up on probation, actually, from what I heard.
Okay, so we're no, I understand, we're no University of Phoenix.
We're not University. Or University of Southern Phoenix. I'm sure there's another one that's doing it. Anyway, so our key recommendations, again, to keep us consistent with our mission. The online teaching and learning doesn't change who we are or what we're trying to accomplish. It just provides an additional tool for us to do so. And our intention is to use that tool to provide really quality education. The preliminary recommendations that have come out of this group, we've held forums, we did a faculty and student survey, we're still making our way through the different survey. The students are gung-ho on this. The faculty are gung-ho, so not so gung-ho. All of the conversation and concerns that you raised today have been raised by the faculty and concern about this. We definitely need to have a way to coordinate across the campus. Right now, the way that we're doing online is, faculty member Jones would like to teach online. He approaches the online course developers. They work it out. His department chair may not know that, but and it might not fit with the program, so it's more faculty initiated, which is great, but we need to have more conversation with departments about where does this fit in the curriculum, not just in the course or the faculty member's schedule, but also in the curriculum. And so that's probably where we'll be starting first, is to involve academic units, not only individual faculty, to invite those who are interested, and not everybody is, and not everybody has the capacity, obviously we're not doing this in biology, to speak with each other about where online teaching and learning might fit with their curriculum. We hope that these conversations will end up with answers anywhere from nowhere to blended, to some courses, to some required, to we want to use this experience to introduce you to students in Germany while we're learning German. All those options are possibilities, and we want that conversation to happen in the academic departments. We want to be able to encourage faculty to engage in experimentation, to try it out, see if it works, evaluate it. And so that's our intention, was to provide that kind of opportunity. And we want to struggle with this question of how do you support students online? The student experience of an online experience, you know, what do they need besides a website URL? What kind of interactions do they need? What kind of community do they need? How do you do it when they are in Water Tower while you're doing this versus when they're across the state while you're doing this? So all of those questions we need to work out. Some of our next steps coming up are continuing to dig into our faculty-student surveys. Our intention is to invite some of the departments that are willing and interested and would like to play with this a bit. History is very interested in it. They'd like to flip their classrooms and so forth, so some other departments are interested. Some courses in some of the science departments that are not lab-based, we might be interested as well. And we'd like to look at the ways in which we can enhance the technology underneath it. We're actually creating a lecture capture system in the new business school building, so we'll be able to flip some more classrooms. And we're also planning additional supports for students and faculty. We're working on what that online IT program is going to look like now that we have the authorization to begin to develop it, and pilots, tests, and experiments with an opportunity for us to see what works for us, what our students want, what our faculty want, and how we can integrate the experience. My last slide here is your comments and questions, but my bet is that you've already done all of those. One more, yes.
So, are we viewing this as a as this is still in the very experimental stage, or are we viewing this as, nope, we're in, it's just a question of how we're going to do the particulars, and
yes,
the latter?
No,
more?
All of the above.
Okay.
So let me just describe what I think, where I think we've come down on this. I don't think you can, in higher education, not engage in some kind of online teaching and learning, just given where things are. Will we move into MOOCs? No. Will we have fully online degrees? And we'll see how this IT one works. Do we have a master plan that will end up that every degree will be completely online? No. Do we have a master plan that every faculty member will be forced into teaching online who doesn't want to? No. What we're really committed to is engaging in an experimental process, but it's we're committed to moving forward in that experimentation.
So pardon me for leading this way, but yeah. So it's clear that we're looking at this from the perspective of, well, how can we get intra-departmental cooperation in terms of having members of faculty are more interested in doing this, lead the development for their departments, but how can we leverage intra-departmental cooperation? Because I imagine, as you said, for instance, history may be taking a very great interest in leading, but what about departments that may cooperate with history that, or that their approach might be able to translate to? Is there any way that we can foster between different departments the ability to try and translate one department's learning into another?
Yeah. The best way that faculty learn is from their peers. The experience of the flipped classroom, our 12 faculty that signed up to try out a flipped classroom, learn from each other as they're going along. We are disseminating their results so that other faculty can know what they did. I expect that what will happen in the course of this development is we'll find perhaps 5 departments that would like to have a deeper conversation about where online teaching and learning fits. We'll provide them with a faculty member from outside the department who has already been there to help them guide. And once they decide where they want to go, we'll tell Department B what happened here and use that as a continuing process of discovery and sharing. So I expect it's will spread.
Thank you.
So is there any plan by the SUNY campuses to start sharing these courses? Because it looks like the wheel is being reinvented at each campus probably for the same gen ed courses. Stony Brook has probably an intro to a course. We have one. Odiana may have it.
Yeah, welcome to my nightmare. there are some who say, well, we have enough English 101s across the system. Yeah. Why don't we just assign it to Stony Brook? or we have, why are so many people teaching Physics 1? Why don't we assign that to Buffalo?
online.
And online. I do believe that we will have a system-wide catalog of online courses. We have almost the equivalent of it now if you go onto SUNY Learning Network. Why I grimace a bit is that if you play that down to its logical extreme, what you end up is having the Department of Physics in Buffalo, the Department of French in Binghamton, Stony Brook's takes care of the rest of the humanities, we're offering psychology and social sciences, and the State University of New York is one big campus, but each of the campuses is no longer a university. And that's a little troubling in terms of a interplay of mixes. That's independent of any of the labor issues or anything like that.
Also cultural issues.
So the other part that makes me grimace is the planning challenges that I imagine happening even as SUNY ramps up and every campus ramps up their offerings online. My humorous example is that the student who I've admitted who's living in Waterman Tower is taking English 101 here and maybe Biology 101 because the lab's here, but they're taking Psych 101 at Binghamton online because they think the instructor is better over there because they've heard, great, my professor said the instructor is better. So they're doing that online, and then they're also taking a gen ed course in history in Oneonta. Probably somebody said during the biology lab class. And so this student who is in my milieu and in my experience and I used to think was going to be taking 5 of my courses is now in 3 other learning communities with 3 different standards I don't know about it until maybe 2 weeks before the semester starts. I don't have a fungible labor force to move the resources around. And that student still is my student, and I need to provide their student experience across all of these experiences. That's what keeps me up at night. Oh,
good. Thank you. If we have any additional questions, may we go online? Pardon for the development report.
This is a real gal, not a virtual gal.
Thank you. Michael left before I could thank him and thank you for a $100,000 gift they made towards the business plan competition, and their gift really makes that competition to become one statewide, and it's a bragging point for our School of Business. As of April 30th, our fundraising results were up 11% compared to last year. We also had a good year last year as well. School of Business campaign is about 85% complete now, which is somewhere around $8.4 million. And we have a number of very solid asks out there, and I'm confident by end of September when we're going to have an official official opening of the school, that campaign be over. We are having a foundation board meeting, and before the foundation board meeting, there's going to be a wonderful lecture by two Nobel laureates who are here for the chemistry conference and the RNA Institute. That I'd like to invite all of you now. You're all going to get invitations. The lecture is going to be at 3 o'clock, followed by a reception, and after that, you could have a private tour of the RNA Institute. And we're also inviting the community for that. We had our direct mail results are excellent. I think some of it has to do with the timing and also the enthusiasm our basketball teams generated. And as all of you have seen, we finally published the magazine here. We had to go out and recruit a supermodel for it. And I believe he's available for off signing the own copy at the meeting. I want to remind everyone, June 30th is the end of our fiscal year, so please keep us in mind, and as I said, keep the doors open for us and keep opening doors for us. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Years ago, voted on a range for naming opportunities.
Yes.
Do those ranges change? Do they increase? Are they revisited periodically where we have that other another opportunity to look at them?
Yeah, if you recall, from time to time, I bring those opportunities back and I ask you to adjust it as there's an interest for them, naming opportunity.
I've done that in a while.
We did it about twice last year.
I mean generically.
Oh, generically.
Right.
I believe, so correct me, when was the last time we did that?
I think it was several years ago, looking at the whole list,
right,
as opposed to the individual ones that you're bringing forward.
I'll bring that. I'll do that. I'll bring that on, and I work with Sorrel and Steve.
Thank you. Any questions? We have three service recognitions in the form of resolutions. Individually, if anybody has any, you want to read them?
We've got them all framed there. I just wanted to let you know.
Okay.
So,
may we go with Christine first? Right. Thank you very much for your service. I think it's a great set where you're here, and then next year you're chair of the Senate faculty. So you get an idea here, and I hope that you will gain some insights into the council here over the last year. And we have with you, so it'll be terrific as you go to the next step, the big step. Thank you for your service. And we can present these. Let me just run down through. The next one would be Ken Kay from the Alumni Association. Yay! Thank you for your service and your gifts over the past. Your chocolates and the tie. And
T-shirts.
And the resolutions are in the packet, and they are an outline, but there's much more to all three of these resolutions. We can read the resolves, but thank you for being at the table and for participating and engaging the council. This is not your last meeting either, nor was the last one. And finally, Sorrel, another farewell.
Steve took over.
Well, I just keep in touch. Paul did a good job in his resolution. But I was, when Sorrel, when we had the event for over at the alumni house, when he retired some another many times, Sorrel talked about the importance of the council. And I think those of us that were there, Dr. Jackson, Abner, we were there, and I think we were taken. And if you would just say two words, I know that you didn't want to, but just a couple of words on the importance of the council that you've seen over the time.
Honestly? It went beyond Section 356 of the New York Education Law, of the specifics of a governing body, governance-related body, on each SUNY campus. It's beyond that, by the way, as you know, the prisons and so all kinds of state entities have gubernatorial appointments. And in my experience over these decades, we brought a board, individuals, I mean, they're all gubernatorial appointments, who added immensely in terms of the diversity of their background and experience. I mean, everyone accuses academia as being in an ivory tower, and they're away from the reality of life, that sort of thing. Of course, we in academia don't think we are. In theory, we think we're in the world. That's in theory. And so having practitioners from business and industry, the professions, government, other than the institution, really added an enormous dimension of insight, particularly when matters came before this body, and then people would raise a question, add a comment, and so on. So it was really a very important body above and beyond the specific requirements of oversight of buildings and grounds and this sort of thing, if you know what I mean. Anyway, that's where the value was, and for me it was a wonderful experience, having served so many decades, to meet these individuals and get to know them. In 25 words or less.
You still tweeted that.
May I have a motion on all three resolutions in recognition of service?
So moved.
So moved. Dr. Jackson? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We will present these. Let's present these. Dr. Jackson, why don't you present them?
Thank you so much.
Is there any other business that should come before the council? If not, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
So moved. Seconded. Jackson, thank you very much. Adjourn.
Hi everyone.
Never invite me.
You know what? I think it's just the fact that
as a recent University of Virginia was tweeting about these students faster.
Never invite me. What do you come from? All I know was my mom.
Dad, would you come from? Thank you very much.
First Monday in May. It's going high.
Yeah, I guess.
Think about it.
Timothy, so anyway, with Kay, do you want the extra water sitting there?
Yes. Exactly. My public has to see this.
I know, these are expensive. I want to keep one for myself.
Oh, please,
I thought it was wonderful.
Oh, thank
I don't
you.
Remember these types of chairs. Were they?
No.
Were they?
No.
Not in the last
thank
year.
You.
The
thank you. Learned it from you.
I thought someone was going to go to that.